This is a roster of all of the members. Again, this is a very community-driven process that we engage lots of folks coming from different sectors participating in these conversations. So the work group had several investment packages that they were choosing from. These were ideas that they generated that came out of our original action plans, reflected the practices that we know work well in our community currently, some that other communities are using. They did a ranking process within the work group, and this is what they came out with. And again, these were the subcommittee's recommendations. They suggested that we emphasize shared housing strategies, trying to capitalize on larger houses that might be out there, sort of an Oxford House style model that has proven very effective for different populations, for youth and for small families and for individuals, then a significant overall increase in our placement and retention services. This is a combination of rapid rehousing dollars, staff that help people find units, move into units, and remain stable in units, an increase in investment and benefits acquisition that's helping people get onto long-term disability. The cash benefit of that is in the $750 a month range. Emphasizing an investment in eviction prevention dollars. This is the reality that many of the people were moving in with rapid rehousing dollars. Something happens in the relatively short term, maybe 3 months, 4 months, 6 months out. We need to be there with rent assistance dollars to help them not lose the unit they worked so hard to get into. Tenant protection team, this was something that came up in the announcement of the state of emergency. We know that people are struggling to get into units sometimes because they're being discriminated against, their rights aren't being respected. A tenant protection team really is a team of lawyers and advocates who can work with people who are trying to get into housing to be successful in overcoming those barriers. And then once they're in housing, you'll see this shows up again on the prevention side, working with tenants to make sure that their rights are being respected, that they're not losing their housing unjustly. The contingency assistance pool, flexible funding. It is the thing that makes our efforts work at the local level. Our providers, when we ask them what is the most important tool we can give you, they will say, give us more flexible client assistance, more flexible rent assistance, so that we can meet the emergent needs of the households that we're trying to serve. And then again, we have a huge and growing need in East County and in Gresham. It's one of the fastest rates of increase in street homelessness we saw in the street count was in East County and Gresham. This prioritizes resources to that community.
Mark, can I just make a comment?
Yes.
Priority number two, placement and retention services. In Mark's prior life, when he was at JOIN, he helped move people from under Morrison Bridge into their first apartment. And one couple that he helped and JOIN help was moved into a unit near Mount Scott Community Center in an apartment complex, which was suitable, I mean, acceptable, but it was not a place that anyone would confuse with first-tier housing. And they got a unit after being outside for 10 years, and that allowed them to begin to stabilize their life. That's beyond Mount Scott, so that's mid-county. And it was on a street that was not well lit with an industrial purpose on the other side of the street. And I will tell you that there was some funky stuff going on in the parking lot and in the area around it. So it was not the safest area. That building has been purchased by out-of-state investors as a real estate play because East Portland is now in play. And the first thing they did is they emptied out the tenants. And so I go back to Fantasia. This is another thing we can't control, but money is coming in here, and this was perfectly acceptable housing, first stop housing for someone who's homeless. And that apartment complex, purchased by out-of-state money, everyone evicted, and now being upgraded so they can get more rents. And the other thing I just want to mention about eviction prevention, it ought to just make our blood vessels pop, that there are people out there that because they're $300 or $400 short on their rent get evicted. And then the parade of horribles follows, and we'll spend thousands dealing with the fallout and a lifetime of dealing with the trauma of the children. And we could have come in at a couple $100 a month to keep them in their apartment. And that's why historically we've prioritized upstream investments like that, because it's a few $100 to keep someone in their home rather than thousands to deal with the fallout.
So that was the housing work group, and now I'm going to ask Andrew McGough from Work Systems to come up and talk to us a little bit about the work that the Employment Income Acquisition Group did. Thanks, Andrew.
Hi, morning.
You've got to hit your button.
Morning, everybody. I'm Andrew McGough. I'm the Executive Director of Work Systems. We're the Workforce Development Board for Metropolitan Portland. I was also a member of the Coordinating Council and the co-chair, along with Rachel Post, who I see in the audience, of the Workforce and Economic Opportunity Team. Rachel and I, as you can see, were joined by a broad array of organizations from across the community. And we also had some community members there who had experienced homelessness, and they were really invaluable in helping to inform the discussion and keeping us on track about what will and won't work. So we got together, and Commissioner Fish, I really appreciate your sort of focus on this notion of on the supply, and we've really got to figure that out. I mean, I totally agree with you. That said, we really kind of focused on the prevention and the retention side, trying to figure out ways, how do we help people acquire income and then advance in their wages to allow them to either avoid homelessness or stay in their homes. So one of our underlying strategies in all this, and I think it's a term we all use pretty loosely, but it really is about intentional alignment, what programs are out there, what services are out there, and how do we put them together to assure not only the best use of the resources, but to create the broad array of services that we know varied populations need to stabilize themselves and ultimately achieve economic self-sufficiency. So quickly kind of going through our recommendations, they, again, are a little bit unique in that they're mostly focused on prevention and retention. But the first one was about bringing workforce to housing. And the idea here was to build on what we think is a pretty successful model, and we call it the Economic Opportunity Program. It's a co-funded program by the city, Work Systems, and then a number of community-based organizations that really focus on connecting highly varied populations to career track employment and the other wraparound supports that they need really to advance in their careers, to acquire the skill training. And so what this would do is extend that model to homelessness and housing providers who are not currently engaged in it. So it would create some resources to help us bring in and widen the tent by bringing in additional organizations into that model. The second recommendation is about bringing housing to workforce. And that's really, again, it's kind of building on this economic opportunity program model, and it provides access to flexible housing supports, rental assistance, if you will, to individuals and households who are engaged in career track employment, but for whatever reason, they need that rental assistance in order to be successful in that training. Another story, Commissioner, is we often encounter people who are either living in their cars or in shelters, but they're attending colleges. So how do we help those folks to continue to be successful in college and acquire those skills that we know that will ultimately help them transition out of homelessness and into self-sufficiency? Our third recommendation is, again, building on this notion of aligning programs and focusing on populations that we know are most vulnerable. And this one is about housing and workforce alignment for TANF families. TANF is the primary public assistance programs, as I'm sure you all know. So this helps us to connect those DHS services, those DHS customers, again, with career track employment offered through the public workforce system, with housing resources and community-based supports. Again, trying to do that wraparound work that we know is so critical for people that have faced multiple barriers to employment. Our fourth recommendation, it's referred to as equitable access to employment, and as was mentioned earlier, people of color are disproportionately represented, majorly disproportionately represented in our homelessness population, And this really recognizes that and tries to work with those organizations who have specific expertise working with culturally specific populations and bringing them together with employer groups, so the PBA, and then also real employment opportunities offered through quasi-public organizations. We have some commitments by organizations like TriMet, like the Port of Portland, to create pathways to move people into jobs that are available in those organizations. And finally, we're looking to expand the Street Roots vendor program to East Multnomah County. I'm sure you're all very familiar with that model. And we know that it creates sort of an immediate path to income for people while at the same time connecting those vendors with a variety of services that are offered either through Street Roots or through partner organizations engaged in that. So those are our recommendations, and appreciate any questions you may have.
Questions for Andrew? You nailed it. Thank you.
That was easy. Thanks a lot, all.
Really appreciate it. All right. Moving then to the work of our healthcare work group. Commissioner Novick, you asked about healthcare expansion. Lots of discussion about opportunities for alignment between health and housing. Manda Saul was one of the co-chairs of that work group and is here to share the work that they did.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. Thank you for having me. My name is Amanda Saul, and I work for Enterprise Community Partners. We're a national nonprofit that invests in low-income housing tax credit projects and invests in the nonprofits that own and build these housing projects. I co-chaired the Health and Homelessness Work Group with Rachel Duke, Rachel Duke, formerly of Home Forward. So just really quickly to give you a little bit of background, our goal was to come up with some actionable recommendations for engaging healthcare providers and funders in Multnomah County to assess the crossover between people experiencing homelessness, to prioritize housing options for those folks, and to further identify health needs and strategies to increase engagement in healthcare. This is a lot about systems alignment work and is a little bit different for the traditional housing folks. And so our recommendations require a collaborative approach and really sort of working across systems in new ways. The work group include 25 experts, from coordinated care organizations, the Oregon Health Authority, the Medicaid insurers, Multnomah County, Oregon Housing and Community Services, hospitals, clinics, and housing and service providers. It was really all levels of the healthcare system involved in the working group, which is, I think, important because just like how our housing system is complicated, our healthcare system is equally as complicated, if not more. And so I think one of the things that we've realized is that we really do know what works. Portland has done a great job combining health and housing for many years through projects like Housing with Services run by Cedars-Sinai Park and other projects done by Central City Concern and Home Forward. There has been lots of research that has been done to show that housing people with chronic illness helps to reduce their Medicaid costs and improve their health outcomes. I think we all know this, and it's not surprising. Just to give you a little bit of idea of the scale, we tried to think about the scale in terms of how people experiencing a health crisis or having chronic health conditions, how that relates to our homeless population. And what we found was that a couple years ago, the point in time homeless count, 53% of those people self-identified as having a disability. So we know that there's overlap between our healthcare system and our housing system. And then in addition to that, HealthShare, which is our largest coordinated care organization in the metro area, according to their data, they have 5,400 what they call high utilizers, or people that use a lot of Medicaid services.
Sorry, 5,400 in the city, county, or
5,400 in Health Shares region, which I believe is the three-county metro area. You're welcome. And so our recommendations that our work group came up with are very similar to what the other work groups came up with. There's a theme, and I think some of that is because we are all working from what are best practices and what are evidence-based delivery systems. And we're all looking to upstream solutions, like your Fantasia example. So our recommendations ranked in order of priority. And then just really quick also to differentiate that that our recommendations are really focusing on the services side, not the capital or construction side. So the housing work group focused on the capital and construction side, and we were really more focused on the services side. So our first recommendation is creating 100 new permanent supportive housing units, which is units sometimes known as housing first or housing units for extremely vulnerable people that need ongoing services and housing to be successful. And then staffing for housing stability and eviction prevention, which is a lot what Mark was talking about earlier. Another 50 units of permanent supportive housing associated with the new Unity Hospital, mental health hospital that's being completed in 2016. Discharge planning in the hospitals and the clinics to help folks who are exiting the hospital find at least temporary housing, if not permanent housing, which a lot of hospitals do currently, and the challenge, as we all know, is just not enough existing housing in our community that's affordable to folks. Specifically, also having a health and homeless project coordinator, so that staff person could either live in a hospital or in a clinic, but really help to connect homeless people and the health system a bit better. A tuberculosis registry, which came up at a meeting that I was not at. So I'm going to ask Mark to jump in on that one.
It's really an access to shelter issue, because shelters require someone to have a valid TB test. And right now there isn't a centralized way of knowing who has taken the test and should be accessing shelter. So it would facilitate that, make access for people much easier than it is currently, where they have to go and get their cards.
Thank you. And then lastly, training, development, and delivery for both the healthcare side and the housing side. I think through this work group, we all realize that we all have very similar struggles. We have similar challenges. If we can identify the gaps and the training needs, perhaps the two systems together can actually help help reduce homelessness in ways where we already have strategies in place and funding. I think there's opportunities to work with the healthcare system more closely in ways where there's already funding that exists.
Amanda, can I just ask, my assumption was we passed the ACA, a whole bunch of people have access to healthcare they didn't before. You would hope a bunch of them become healthier. What has actually happened with people on the street? Have they not been signed up for the ACA? Have they been signed up but haven't found providers? Have they been signed up and found providers, and as a result, we have a lot fewer people homeless because we have a lot fewer people that are dealing with mental health and addiction issues?
I can respond anecdotally, I suppose. We have been very successful in signing people up for healthcare. And I know from talking to people who work within the coordinated care organizations, one of their struggles is how to actually track down those homeless people and say, you have healthcare, we need to actually get you in to see your primary care provider, or use alternate ways to ensure that your health is handled in a preventative way. And so this coordinated care organizations are actually now starting to hire people, and we're looking at ways to, when people come into a clinic or come into a hospital, have as one of their questions is, are you homeless? Or what is your housing situation? And sort of be able to identify those people a little bit better.
It would be nice at some point to have a percentage estimate of, here's what percentage of homeless people are not in the sign up for the ACA and should be. Here's what percentage are signed up but haven't actually accessed any care. And it also seems to me that this should be like part of our state agenda to be asking them to prioritize making sure that people who are eligible for care actually get it.
So let me, oh, so go ahead.
If you're outside, you may not necessarily be able to remember that your appointment is 10 o'clock on Tuesday or to get to it. So I that is a piece I'm kind of concerned is not in your ranked priority strategies, because my understanding is that most people are in fact signed up, but that they're not able to get to providers either because they can't or because there aren't any providers.
So let me pose another issue and get your reaction to it in terms of how this new, more coordinated effort might respond. Might ask the county folks and the safety off the street folks to do the same, and that is, you know, partly anecdotal information, partly statistical. You know, the police bureau ends up being the mental health first responder. They're doing a better and better job averting suicides and otherwise addressing it. The Unity Center and housing coming out of the Unity Center seems to be a pretty coordinated, multi-jurisdictional, public-private response. Good so far. Similar issue, our police bureau are increasingly using Naxalone on the street to deal with people that are in heroin overdose. They are the first responders because often they're there even before our EMTs can get there. We appear to be in a significant wave of heroin addiction driven by all kinds of factors. One is, of course, overprescription of opioids by the medical community, some of the same folks we're working with. And another, ironically, according to information from Colorado, might be that the legalization of marijuana has caused street dealers to cut the price of heroin. Oops, didn't see that one coming. So for whatever causal reasons, we've got, you know, a huge increase in the rate of heroin addiction. Some of those folks are homeless, some of them aren't. Increases a lot of the friction between the homeless issues and the community. If you look at the Unity Center example, where, okay, the police bureau is out there, you know, cycling people through, picking people up in mental health crisis, taking them into a general purpose ER, having them discharged and rinse and repeat and do it all over again. We can do better than that. Now we're going to have the Unity Center. Now we're going to have hopefully housing coming out the back door of the Unity Center. Can you sketch, you know, or now and later, can you sketch a similar model for how we might collectively get upstream in the heroin issue locally, even if it's just like mental health, if it's a national issue, it's here too, but we got smarter. It seems to me we've gotten smarter on the mental health side. How do we get smarter on the heroin addiction or on drug addiction as well between all of us?
This is way outside of my normal. Yeah. But I think, you know, addiction, whether it's any addiction, you know, needs to be approached with services and with you know, similar to how we approach mental illness. We know that addiction services are covered by Medicaid. So if that person is on Medicaid, you know we have some ability to bill for those services. In Oregon, there's also, because of our state Medicaid waiver, we have something called flexible services or flexible benefits funding, which can really be used in a flexible way. So it could be used to pay for rental assistance. It could be used to pay for services. It could be used to pay for that coordination that's required to get those people, you know, off the streets into a hospital and then get them housed. The CCOs and other folks are not accessing those benefits because they didn't come with any new money. And so how can we make policy changes, or how can we incentivize the CCOs and the big hospital systems to actually look at new ways to use these Medicaid sources?
Can I follow up on that for a second? Because we've been having this conversation for a long time. And we now know beyond any doubt that getting someone into stable housing saves a fortune in otherwise uncompensated, what used to be called uncompensated medical care, but now maybe picked up through the Affordable Care Act. Let's use Leo Rhodes as a great example. Someone that we're all familiar with, street roots vendor, waited a very long time to get, from his point of view, to win the lottery, got a home forward unit, and his health has turned around, and he's no longer dealing with his health challenges on the street. He has a home, and he has a place to sleep, and he's made a lot of changes in his life that he's allowed to now that he has a home. So if we know that we can save a lot in unnecessary medical costs by housing someone, why can't we yesterday convince our friends at the hospitals and the CCOs to start allocating more money to help us meet the goals of the supportive housing? And again, Commissioner Novick wrote had raised this at sort of a high level several years ago. Commissioner Fritz, RN, has raised this repeatedly. The council talks about it. And here we are in the middle of a crisis, and we're still talking about it. How do we make progress on this rather than just identify it as a no-brainer?
So Enterprise just commissioned a study that's actually going to be out in the next couple weeks. We hired Providence's Center for Outreach, Education, and Reform, something like that. I just bungled the acronym, but to actually look at the costs of the Medicaid costs associated with people living in stable, affordable housing, and then also to go a little bit deeper and look at what services helped to reduce Medicaid costs and increase health outcomes. And we looked at three different populations. We looked at people living in permanent supportive housing, people who are families, and people who are living in senior buildings specifically for seniors and people living with disabilities. And we're able to show, you know, based on research, that just living in stable, affordable housing saves Medicaid $48 per member per month, which is not, that doesn't sound like a big number to us coming from housing development, but that, according to Medicaid people, actually makes a difference. We're able to further show that by providing services, that savings actually gets to $115 per member per month. And so I think the healthcare system has made some changes, but they are very research-based, very data-driven. They want to know that what they're, you know, they think of it as a prescription. You know, they want to know that the prescription that they're giving, if it's for rental assistance or housing, is actually going to work.
See, I think it's wonderful to identify the savings. It's like the vaunted peace dividend we've been waiting for out of the federal government. The problem is just identifying the savings without sharing the fruits of that effort doesn't get us anywhere. And if we said, just for instance, for every dollar we save, we'll take 50 cents to invest in permanent supportive housing, now that creates a long-term solution. Just reducing the inflow of Medicaid dollars is wonderful, I guess, overall in the system, but doesn't build the structural support. And I guess I'm still not clear why we haven't been able to just get whatever change in the law is necessary to allow the CCOs to be our full partner in investing in the housing that keeps people out of the emergency room.
I was going to say, I think some of those recommendations will come out with the report, which will hopefully help to move the conversation. Mm-hmm. I also think just having this work group where you're bringing the housing people and the healthcare system people together helps the conversation to move along. But I agree, it has been a long time coming.
Well, and I think part of the challenge is there's not enough money in the healthcare system. So getting upstream and the healthcare issues is their first priority. And then hopefully they'll get to housing. But first, we need to get more people into preventative care and have more providers.
And I was just going to say that I think this work group is, we're trying to create the forum for that. And the folks that are coming around the table can continue that conversation and look for the opportunities. So I'm mindful of the time we've got. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you very much. So taken together, the health, the housing, the health, and the employment work group recommendations, we haven't gone through it in detail, but get us to that 1,350 placements and the 1,000 retentions, and there's a lot of overlap. So when we took it as staff and to work through the different investment strategies that groups had, there was a path we could see forward that turned into the increased placement and retention numbers that are our targets. But importantly, we had the 650 safety off the streets. I want to take a moment for that conversation because there's so much discussion right now in the community around shelter. The person who helped lead that group is Shannon Singleton, and she's here, so I'll ask her to come up and join us.
Good morning. Apparently, it's the day for sick people to come and talk to you guys, so bear with me. So I'm Shannon Singleton. I'm the executive director at JOIN and a member of the Home for Everyone Coordinating Board. Membership in this group was really broad and included folks from the business community, people sleeping outside, as well as providers. We utilized a modified consensus to get to some decision making, primarily because, as you may be aware of, sometimes it looks like we're on really different ends of this spectrum when we look at what does safety off the streets mean. You'll see that we have a very minimum definition of safety off the streets with some things that are qualifiers that we expect to see. Those include that people are legally able to sleep there, that there's some sort of heat or warmth, that there's access to restroom facilities, that they are clean, and that there's folks there who are trained to provide at least some physical safety for people. The piece that we really highlighted in this group was the need to have service connection to these options. The Safety Off the Streets work groups does not want to see shelters or other alternative sheltering options be put up without access to permanent housing placement. So we'd really like to see mobile services and linkage to permanent housing placement, access to rent assistance, and other types of operational support. That's why you'll see the top priority being strengthen existing safety off the streets options and expanding non-traditional safety off the streets options, followed by expanding facility-based shelter and then shelter diversion. I think one of the caveats that's important to remember about this work group in particular is our numbers are going to look a little odd. Some of our non-traditional options for safety off the streets mean that people would still count as homeless in the HUD definition, but we agreed as a group that this still provided some options for them to sleep safely so we could connect them to services. I'm always at the end because I'm real concise.
Thanks very much. Questions for thank you. Get so, better. We need you out there.
So. On this, I think Shannon mentioned it last week. George Devendorf, who's the director of Transition Projects, was here and talked about making sure that we had a dollar in permanent housing placement services for every dollar that we put into emergency shelter. We're actually hoping to be more aggressive than that. So we're talking about $5 million to run shelter capacity and $12.5 million to move people out of shelter and off the streets and into permanent housing because it really is that critical. We would much prefer to create shelter capacity by moving people out of our existing beds and into permanent housing than by adding more beds. We have to do both, but we want to make sure we're maximizing the permanent housing placement.
Mark, is that where he got to the $12,000 per person figure? It's the combination of the short-term shelter plus the services to get someone housed?
I don't call the $12,000 figure. He was saying $600,000 for a year of shelter, $600,000 he wanted to see per, and so I don't remember how he did the math exactly.
To $1.2 million.
A combined cost for housing placement and shelter for 100
And then
people.
You divide it by the number of people we're right. serving, we get the, okay.
All right, thank you, Shannon. So this is the work group work. We're going to go quickly. The coordinating board wrestled with all of the recommendations. That was their job. And Alexandra Appleton is here. She is a coordinating board member, went through this process. And I asked her to just come and talk about the work that they did so that you can understand what went forward to the executive committee. Thank you for joining us, Alexandra.
Mayor and city council members, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Alexandra Appleton, and I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon, and I'm an appointed member for the Home for Everyone Coordinating Board. as well as being a member of the coordinating board. I work at Mercy Corps Northwest Reentry Transition Center within the housing coordination team, and I'm a council member for the Women's West Domestic Violence Center, and I'm also a PSU student. Last year, a colleague sent me the application for the Home for Everyone, and I'm grateful because here I am. And as an appointed member of the board, my hopes are to offer my experience and insights about the problems that the homeless face, because these problems are directly related to the many other problems faced by homeless. We've talked about those things like jobs and adequate health care and recovery from addiction, and as well as racial and developmental discrimination. Over the past several months, I brought my voice and perspective to the Home for Everyone's work in prioritizing the potential allocation of housing resources in a productive and efficient ways to benefit as many people as possible. As you've heard, it was essential to put the PIPs, the proposed investment priorities, in ranking order depending on issue status, projected outcome, and long-term need. While referring back to the collective recommendations, the data on racial disparities, and the particular expertise necessary to help people gain self-sufficiency, there was a wide range of ranking possibilities, and there was also consideration of combining the PIPs in order to achieve a better outcome, and there was also some PIPs that could be applied to more than one specific group. During the whole process, the Home for Everyone's objectives and goals were reiterated during the ranking, and a consistent reminder to all the members was not to focus necessarily on how much it was going to cost, but instead to focus on like what plans do we need to create to end homelessness. One of the things that I always remind myself is repairing the years and the generations of deprivation is not going to happen overnight and within a couple months of supported housing, and depending on the circumstances, stabilization may take years. For example, in my own case, my children and I have experienced such vulnerability, and as a survivor of homelessness, criminality, substance abuse, trafficking, and domestic violence, I know how difficult it is to raise a family and to address the barriers without a home. So I have a good understanding of what it takes to overcome such hardships and gain stability, and I express that through the way I prioritize by not sacrificing one for the other, and I think that's really important. On an end note, during this whole time and on a daily basis, I keep a few things in mind, which is the homeless and the vulnerable populations are the most resourceful and resilient communities. And in my experience, both personally and at my job, there's a strong desire for ourselves and for our families to be independent and break the cycle of poverty. To our credit, even under the worst circumstances, when we do gain stability, we help the next suffering person achieve their independence. So this has to be a communal effort, and I am certain that the prioritizing work that the Home for Everyone contributes to its initiative to end homeless has been on point. I'm pretty good at that. I'm pretty sure of that. This is a good start, and of course, there's so much more work to be done. Specifically, the time has come for us to start allocating the resources and put plans into action. And I just want to thank you again for letting me speak.
Thank you. Thank you for your help with this. Just maybe get you to answer one question from your perspective, and that is, you know, we as elected officials and the folks in this room that are doing the work are dealing a lot of the time with people in the community that don't understand, don't have the lived experience. And I think you probably understand this particularly because of your work at Mercy Corps, but we seem to be experiencing some compassion fatigue that people just want it to go away. What would you say to those folks?
I would say be patient. It's not going to go away unless we do something about it. I know it's hard to put... you know, it's kind of like one of those things, a lot of people think of it like if the shoe fits, it wear it, but it's not necessarily like that, because sometimes you need to just buy a whole different shoe. And all I can say is that I just keep reminding myself is that what's lacking is that a lot of people forget what we have to bring to the table. Although we're homeless and we have all these issues and we have a lot of barriers and we just have so much to overcome, if we're given a chance and we can utilize it, then the community becomes better overall. And I think a lot of people forget about how much we can bring to the table. All we do is forget about just push them under the table. But if we give people a chance, not only will they gain stability, but they also want to be part of the community, and they can help in the process of building a better future. So, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Alexandra. All right. So, hopefully that gives you a sense of what we've gone through to land on some very specific recommendations. And I'm going to race through them because we don't have time, and I want to make sure we don't lose the opportunity to hear from Joe and Kurt. But in essence, to achieve the 1,350 placements, you'll see it's a combination of about 1,160 rapid rehousing placements and about 190 additional permanent supportive housing placements using a mix of the prioritized strategies that the work group came up with. There is an emphasis on eliminating the overrepresentation of people of color in the community. We think we can do that. We can house 1,000 additional women with this resource, some in rapid rehousing, some in permanent supportive housing. And in this resource allocation, we can house at least an additional 57 people with severe and persistent mental illness in addition to the 190 chronically homeless people. Then going to the prevention side, again, we're going to achieve this 1,000 additional preventions and diversions through a mix of strategies. About 550 preventions, meaning someone currently has permanent housing, they're going to lose it if we don't intervene. Diversion is where someone may not have permanent housing right now, but they're doubled up or they're coming out of a hospital or out of a jail, and they're going to wind up in the shelters or on our streets if we can't help them identify permanent housing. So a number of strategies serving people with disabilities in the housing they currently have or coming out of the hospitals. And here again, you see some general investment in tenant protection team and transportation assistance, things that we know can help keep people from becoming homeless or from coming into the shelters or onto the streets. And then finally, coming to safety off the streets, here you see, again, a heavy emphasis on sheltering women in both facility-based and alternative strategies. The sum total is about 410 additional traditional facility-based shelter beds and 265 alternative options for safety off the street.
What do you mean by alternative?
So our traditional purpose-built shelter, like the ones, the Bud Clark Commons or the Clark Center, is sort of one version. It has a certain cost structure and service package around it. We have alternatives like everything from Right to Dream to church-based shelters to something like Sears, where we're in there on a temporary basis, that can be more cost-effective in terms of a per person, per dollar invested, may better leverage the resources that the homeless community brings to the table themselves. So it's opening that door up to recognizing that we don't have the resource right now to put everyone in traditional facility-based shelter, that we can create safety options, and so long as we're connecting people to permanent housing options out of whatever those safety options are, we're meeting that need in our community.
Mark, I know we're running short on time. Can Kurt join us for a second? Since one of the questions I think we'll have is the interplay between these recommendations and the budget process.
Yeah. So I think pretty much finished. This is again your the graph we started with, what we're trying to achieve, and those are your coordinating board members.
Maybe it would be good if Joe came up.
Yeah, Joe, would you like to come up too if you're here, Joe Zender? So the remaining two conversations are on the development side and then the shelter siting. And I appreciate you both joining us today.
Good morning. Housing Bureau Director Kurt Krieger. And happy to answer questions, but I'll defer to Joe to introduce himself first.
Joe Zender, Chief Planner, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability.
And I have a few presentation slides to make available to you. It's cached at the bottom of the toolbar there. I think everybody has one. You get one. Absolutely. The other thing I'd like to do is Metro on February 1 issued a equitable housing report, and they actually captured and humanized the spectrum of housing need by looking at people with 0 to 30% of AMI up to market rate. And this is very helpful because people, you know, we get very clinical and we talk about people and people's incomes, but we're basically talking about minimum wage workers and people on Social Security and Social Security disability. That doesn't mean that they don't have potential for greater earning, and oftentimes they do, but that portion of the housing spectrum doesn't exist by itself. It interfaces with people between 30 and 60% of AMI and up to market rate. And when we housers talk about housing needs, we talk usually about different elements of the spectrum, so I want to make sure that you're at least aware of the role that 0 to 30 plays in that regard. Let me call up the slides here real quick.
Yeah, is there? Yeah, go ahead and.
Located in our homeless and housing system is our PA.
Well, Mayor, there's a great irony here. We now have instructions. We have instructions for how to use the microphones. We've gone through this entire proceeding with the microphones working, and yet you and I both have microphones that say "do not use." So I just
that was confusing.
I'm feeling those
three buttons. Yeah.
I'm feeling whipsawed here. I don't know which instruction.
The home audience can now see what I'm talking about with respect to these slides. So I won't dwell on the spectrum, but I'll leave it as a leave-behind piece, and we can talk about it a little bit later if we have time. My real purpose today was to talk specifically about the 0 to 30% portion of the Housing Bureau's portfolio. And I actually started diving into this several months ago. And what I felt was important to call to your attention is that this exists with other resources at play. For example, we have about 13,200 units in the entire PHB portfolio. Of those, by design, about 2,112 are structured to be affordable to people between 0 and 30% of median income. of those, about 1,000 have project-based rental assistance vouchers, and others are supported financially. So that's about 16% of the total. But then I started asking the question about what of the 6,000 home forward vouchers are in housing units that we own? Because when you have a voucher, as Commissioner Fish has mentioned, people are essentially guaranteed not to pay more than 30% of their income for utilities and rent. And we have nonprofit partners and other partners who have an open door for folks with vouchers. So we look specifically, and I want to laud Home Forward for making this data available, but we did a data scrape of all their units, and these are tenant-based vouchers where people are voluntarily choosing to use that. And we found that of the 6,000 vouchers, about 1,025 of them are actually used in PHB properties. So that basically elevates the 0 to 30 portfolio to about 24% of the total. We then wanted to look at the short-term rental assistance because you have, through direct investments, provided 18 months to help bridge people into longer-term settings, the idea being that they're on a waiting list for permanent housing, public housing, perhaps a permanent voucher of their own. And we have 1,550 of those households that receive assistance from the city. And indeed, many of those folks, 400, are in properties that are assisted by the Portland Housing Bureau. So of the total units that we own and manage, 13,197, about 27% are for 0 to 30 households, both by design and then by happenstance, people are using both short-term rental assistance and vouchers in those units. So I think it's meant to show that it's a resilient stock, and obviously as more short-term rental assistance is made available, that stock can serve that population. I might add that of the 6,000 vouchers, course, nearly 4,800 or so are in the private market. And those are important assets. I think it's laudable that private landlords make those units available, but they're not obligated to make them available. And as the market has gotten more and more robust, more and more landlords have decided to opt out of the program. We have taken some steps to help mitigate that. The utilization rate, as you will recall, in the fall budget modification process by Home Forward was some 75%. You allocated about $445,000 to help improve voucher utilization. Some of that went to pay for Washington State University to do a rent comparability study, and HUD about 7 days ago increased the fair market rents for the Portland metro area by 33%. The other $400,000 is made available to cover arrears that tenants might have, unpaid utility bills that are barriers for them to receive a placement with a new housing unit. Even though they might have a voucher, they might not be able to use it until those arrears are settled. And we are matching funds with Home Forward to pay for 3 culturally competent navigators so that households that have language or cultural differences with the property owners can help navigate the process a little bit more easily. So those things working together, I think, will help us maximize the potential. And I realize that there's a great deal of interest in serving the poorest of the poor, and the previous dialogue was very clear in that regard. I do want to understand.
Let's just be clear. A full-time minimum wage worker, in our community is eligible for a 0 to 30.
That's correct.
So when we say poorest of the poor, yes, people on Social Security, people that are formerly homeless have no income, but a full-time minimum wage worker, a cashier is just above the line. So we talk about poorest of the poor, we're talking about people that are hardworking, playing by the rules in entry-level jobs that have no chance to find affordable housing. They're not
Indeed.
Just the formerly homeless and others.
Yeah.
And there's 24,000 people in that category.
Indeed. And I think it's worth repeating, and that's why I wanted to humanize this a little bit so that we get above and beyond the numbers. There are some reasons why we undertake mixed income developments, and I think it's important to underscore that. One is financial sustainability of the property itself. Extremely low incomes don't pay enough rent to cover rent, utilities, the cost of maintaining and operating the property. So the Home Forward vouchers are helpful because that's an offset. The landlords receive a cash offset to their operating costs. So financial sustainability of the portfolio is quite important. The second, as we undertake projects in new areas, we try to gain neighborhood acceptance. And having a mixed income approach where you're infusing extremely low income people within a larger property actually helps us attain that acceptance. If we were trying to locate projects that were 100% extremely low income, we would have fewer options with neighbors to do so. And a corollary to that is by including extremely low income people in a larger mixed income setting, they are not isolated or segregated. They have opportunities. They have a lot of contact with other people. And then finally, much of our planning goals has to do with retail viability of multifamily properties, especially as we look at the 2035 comp plan. So market feasibility of commercial aspects of mixed-use developments are greatly enhanced with a mixed-use approach, a mixed-income approach. So we agree that it's important to have a strong emphasis on the 0 to 30, but we want to make sure that you always take into account the tempering aspects of why you want to do a mixed-income portfolio.
You know, in terms of your handout, is it a good thing, a bad thing, or a wash that Home Forward Section 8 vouchers are being paired up with our stock, so in effect 2 subsidies are being tied up for 1 unit? Is it, in a perfect world, wouldn't the Section 8 voucher be purely in a private market unit, and then we would be directing our subsidies to our regulated units to get a bigger bang for the buck?
Well, the only ones that are specifically tied are the project-based rental assistance vouchers. And in the current NOFA, we have 100 or so available out of the entire offering. So I think in a perfect world, you would be buying down private-owned units.
And you would basically lever into the stock of affordable housing units, units that would otherwise be lost. I must say that in some respects, because of the high quality of the properties that the PHB is managing and our nonprofit partners' commitment and the physical location of these properties, they're very attractive to folks, that they can choose to live in a high opportunity area in a property owned by a CDC, which is affordable to them. And they have shopping ability. They can take this voucher to Sacramento if they want to, right? So it's obviously highly attractive for them to use those vouchers in permanently affordable stock. The other thing I would say is that if you are in a privately owned voucher unit, the landlord can opt out of the program. So you don't necessarily have certainty or long-term assurances.
So if, I just want to make sure I understand the future here. So we're trying to address this gap. And if there's 24,000 people that are priced out, and we have less than a third of our inventory targeted at 0 to 30, we have a lot of work to do going forward. The inclusionary zoning debate in Salem has now inexplicably shifted to 80%. According to this chart, that means we're focused on police officers, high school teachers, very worthy. We want to keep them in the city. Has nothing to do with the people on the street that we've declared an emergency around. So it's a complete mismatch. We had an RFP that came to council recently with 5% of the units set aside for 0-30. It's going to take an awful long time for us to build the inventory. So what's the mechanism for us to over the next 10 years close this gap systematically? And what do you want us to do at budget time to help you? Because I know you're deeply committed to it, and so is the Bureau, but what do you need us to do as a budget committee to help you move the ball?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because we're in the midst of budget, and the CBO is recently, as 10:30 this morning, is giving us specific direction about sort of the budget. I think it's important to note that our fiscal 2016-17 budget does respond to the Home for Everyone Executive Committee's request. It does place into, at least proposes, 50% of the necessary funding. As Mark explained, the current split of the increased funds was really a 2/3, 1/3 split. we think that, at least insofar as we developed our budget, we felt like a 50-50 split was worthy. I think that's a debate that we'll have to play out at council, and we'll respond to questions when they come.
50-50.
The 50-50 split being a 50% county, 50% city split. We haven't seen the county's budget yet, so I provided them with my budget, but we haven't seen their budget yet. So I think that will be an important starting point. The other thing that I'd like to mention is that the CBO has asked us for about 8 packages as it relates to our modified base budget. About $3 million of that goes into various shelter activities, the intense street engagement, the women's winter shelter, and veterans rental assistance are all priorities that CBO is asking us for greater detail on. but I would underscore the fact that we're not just serving the homeless. We're trying to provide rent stabilization and rental rehabilitation stability in East Portland. So several of the DP packages relate to rental rehab in East Portland and homeownership assistance in East Portland, because we can't ignore the realities of gentrification in some of these rapidly changing neighborhoods. The other thing that I think it's my job to do is to put as many new tools into play as possible in advance of a voter-approved bond measure, so that people can't use the excuse that we're not using all the tools at our disposal as a reason to vote no. So the 2017 budget does contain some $14 million in revenue created by the securitization of the transient lodging tax into a bond. That is fungible, not necessarily tied to projects that we own, unlike a general fund backed bond would be. So that gives you some flexibility. And it can be used outside of URAs, which is a terribly important point to make, because most of our funds are tied to the 8 open URAs. and we will be actively working to help improve the state policy as it relates to inclusionary housing. I'm not willing to give up just yet. We still have another week or so.
Going down this afternoon. I don't want to waste the trip.
Absolutely.
So,
what we made it clear is that
any financial assistance the city of Portland puts into housing won't be for populations above 80% of AMI. We simply have too deep an unmet need under 80% of AMI to be making those kinds of commitments. And legally, most of the source